Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. How do we deal with being disappointed or let down by someone we loved, trusted, and respected? We must have some expectations with people. Otherwise, how do we learn and develop ourselves? So yes, of course, we have to have some expectations as we move through the world. We speak so frequently in satsang, in programs, in all of the spiritual literature about the importance of non-attachment, about the importance of no expectations. Pujya Swamiji always says, expectation is the mother of frustration. But the second part of what he says is acceptance is the mother of peace and joy. And the reason it's important to remember both of those is the opposite of the frustration that we get from expectation is the peace and joy that we get from acceptance. It's not never expect. It's always accept what happens, even if it wasn't what you expected. So for example, in order for us to move through the world, we have to expect that our house won't burn down while we're asleep in it overnight. Otherwise, there's no way you could fall asleep at night if you weren't pretty sure that your house would still be standing when you woke up in the morning, that your loved ones would still be next to you in bed or in the room next to you. You couldn't go to sleep. I mean, who could go to sleep if you didn't expect that your house or your children or your spouse or your parents would still be there when you woke up in the morning? When we cross the street, we have to expect that a car is not going to accelerate when they see us and try to run us over. Otherwise, we'd never be able to cross the street. As we sit here in the room, we have to expect that the roof is not going to fall on us, that whoever built this room built it with the commitment to excellence and the knowledge and the expertise that one should have. Otherwise, we'd all rush out of this room immediately. So in order for us to live, there have to be some expectations. Similarly, in our relationships, in order for me to give myself fully to you, I have to expect that you're not going to hurt me. If I'm going to give you my heart, and I'm going to love you with all I am and all I have, I have to expect that you're not going to take a knife and stab it in my heart while I sleep, literally. But I also have to expect that you're going to take my love as the precious gift that it is, and you're not going to throw it on the ground and stomp on it and hurt me. These are the expectations we have to move through the world with. Otherwise, we would literally be paralyzed. Or we would have to be so emotionless. I mean, can you imagine what it would take in your own heart to live in such a way that you went to sleep every night with no expectation that the world would be there in the morning. That you stepped off the curb with no expectation that the cars would stop. That you got in an airplane with no expectation that it wouldn't fall out of the sky. You'd have to either be paralyzed or numb. So we have expectations. Those are not the problem. Expecting that people are not going to hurt me is not the problem. Expecting the airplane's not going to fall out of the sky is not the problem. The problem is what happens when that which we didn't expect happens. Didn't think you were going to hurt me? You did. Didn't think that plane my parents was on was going to crash? It did. Didn't think that a fire was going to burn down my house overnight? It did. Thought my loved one was going to be there when I woke up in the morning? They weren't. Or maybe their body was, but their soul had left the body. That becomes the question. And this is where our spiritual practice comes in with acceptance, is the awareness, A, that we have no control over it. The anger that so many of us feel is an anger at having had an expectation, not just that certain things are going to happen in the universe, but that I had some control over it. For example, I plan a picnic for my birthday. I plan it with the expectation that it's going to be a sunny day. I certainly know it could rain. It rains. Most of us would be slightly disappointed, but we wouldn't be absolutely furious. Why? Because we didn't have an expectation of control. We expected that in the summertime it was going to be sunny, not rainy. But we didn't really have an expectation that the weather was going to do what we wanted. We were just taking a gamble. It was a good gamble. 99% of the days in summer, it doesn't rain. But we always knew there was that 1% chance, and we took the risk. We're disappointed, but not furious. With other things that happen, the reason we become so hurt and so furious is it's not just that we had the little expectation of how it was going to be, but there was also an element of control. That somehow my wanting it, my expecting it, it being right, means that that's what should happen. That me being a good person or my parents being good people should somehow mean that bad things don't happen. That me loving you should mean that you treat me well. So it's not just that I expect it because that's the usual. Most planes don't fall out of the sky. Most nights the house bus doesn't burn down. Most times when we treat someone with love, they treat us back with love. But we actually have another layer of expectation that somehow I have control over this because it's right or because it's what I want. And this is what creates the problem, because this is what leads to not just disappointment, not just sadness, but the inability to accept, the absolute fury, the how dare you feeling. Very few of us would look up at the clouds and say, how dare you? We understand the weather's got its own pattern, some fluke, something happened. But with people in our lives, we have such built-in expectations and control that it's literally the how dare you. And the important thing to remember is we have no more control over the people around us than we do over the weather. Everyone is living out their own karmic package. Doesn't mean they weren't trying, doesn't mean they're not good people, doesn't mean they didn't intend to love us and to treat us well. It's just that everyone is going through their own karmic package. And as I always say, everyone's got their own toolbox. If I've got a toolbox in my hands and I come upon a nail, well, what the situation requires is a hammer. In order to effectively deal with the nail, I should be able to pull a hammer out of my toolbox and hammer it back in. But if I don't have a hammer in my toolbox, if all I've got in my toolbox is a paintbrush, I'm not going to be able to deal with that nail in an effective way. I'll try. I'll pull my paintbrush out and I'll smack the nail. But chances are I'm going to hurt my wrist. I might injure the wall. I might get paint on it if there's still leftover paint on my paintbrush. I might hurt my paintbrush. But not because I intended to make such a mess of the situation. I just didn't have the right tool in my toolbox. And in our lives, when situations arise that require patience, or that require compassion, or that require understanding, or resilience, or surrender, or compromise, or all of these things that are so crucial in our relationships. Well, if I don't have that in my toolbox, if all I've got in my toolbox is anger and fear and reaction, then even though the situation requires patience, I don't have it. And our toolbox gets created and built based on so many aspects of our lives, our childhood, our parents, our own experiences, our education. That's how we build up our toolboxes. We don't, unfortunately, come into this world with a toolbox. Anybody ever notice how patient a baby is? How compassionate of other people's needs a baby is? Yeah, not very. What do you mean mom needs to sleep? I want to eat. What do you mean you've got something else to do? I want to eat. These toolboxes get developed. But if through situation, through our family situation, through our education, through our experiences, we didn't end up having models. Because that's what it is. I mean, if I go to a restaurant and I've got a bill and I have to calculate a tip, or we each have separate bills and we have to calculate what's the total, well, I'm going to rely on my mathematics skills, my addition skills, my subtraction skills, assuming I've got them. Where did I get them? I got them in school. They were modeled to me by a teacher who stood there with a chalkboard. And she wrote addition, and then she made me do it over and over and over again so that now in life, if I'm sitting there and there's a bill, I can figure it out. I can figure out what 15% of most things is. It was modeled for me. But if nobody ever modeled patience for me, because this stuff we don't learn in school, unfortunately. Along with mathematics, we really should have classes in life. How to be patient, how to be compassionate, how to accept, how to have understanding. But we don't learn it in school, and if we don't get it from our parents or our immediate family, or the world around us, we end up with a toolbox that's empty. Or that's full of that which was modeled, impatience, anger, reaction. And so that's what I respond with. So when you're on the receiving end, when you're the nail in the paintbrush situation, and it feels like, what in the world is this person doing? It's so obvious that in this moment, I need a hammer. We feel, I need love, I need understanding, I need patience, I need care, I need loyalty. And when those around us are not able to give it to us, we get angry. But if we can look at it as they don't have it in their toolbox, they're responding with what they do have. And to recognize the problem's not us. It's not that I can't recognize the nail. It's just I don't have the ability to deal with it effectively, skillfully. And so that's the way to handle these situations is certainly, if I'm a nail, I expect that hammers are going to know what to do with me. But on the occasion where there is no hammer, where there's a paintbrush, well, I'm going to get whacked around. I'm going to get paint splattered on me. I'm not going to get hammered in properly. I might end up flat on my side against the wall. Because all the person in that situation had was a paintbrush. And not allow ourselves to get furious at it. My favorite quotation on this is the quotation from Swami Dayanand Saraswati Ji Maharaj, who said, success is not what you make, not what you earn, not what your degree is or your title is. Success is how you respond to the inevitable times, they will happen, when the universe does not act in the way you think it should. So that's our spiritual practice. How do I react? I had an expectation. It wasn't fulfilled. Now is where my test comes in. How can I find acceptance? And remember, lastly, acceptance doesn't mean condoning it. It doesn't mean I think it's okay. It doesn't mean it's okay to have my heart stomped on. It doesn't mean it's okay to be cheated on. It doesn't mean it's okay for the roof to fall on us or a driver to plow us down. Or for your loved one not to be there when you wake up in the morning. Acceptance doesn't mean it's okay. It just means I don't have any control over anything except my reaction. And I really, really, really want to live in peace. I really want to experience joy in life. And until and unless I can create space in my heart, in my life, in my mind for the fact that this happened, I'm not going to be able to experience peace or joy.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me.
What is the purpose of idol worship, ritual practice, and spiritual expression? Can these be practiced if one is not religious? First of all, it's important to mention what Pujaswamiji always says, which is we're not idol worshippers, we are ideal worshippers. Not ideal as in we are the best worshippers, but ideal as in the worshippers of ideals, rather than the worshippers of idols. Think for a moment of someone you really, really, really love, just who the mere thought of just makes your heart go like this. Now, imagine you're away from that person temporarily, by choice or not by choice, by school, by holiday, maybe tragically by illness or death or separation. Now you've got a picture of that person. And you look at the picture of that person. And suddenly, in that picture, you experience that love. You can do it without the picture, of course. You can just close your eyes and think about that person. You don't need the picture. But most of us, when we're in love, we like to keep a picture of the loved one in our wallets. Now with phones, you know, we make it the wallpaper on our phone or our screensaver on our phone or whatever it is. Because even though we can picture it in our minds, there's something very, very special about having the image in front of us, and it calls us back. I remember after I first came to India and was here for the first few months, and then Pujaswamiji sent me back for a while to California, back to school, I had in my assignment book, I had a picture of Pujaswamiji and I had this picture of Krishna that someone had given me in Vrindavan. And of course, I mean, in my mind, all I had to do was close my eyes or not even close my eyes. I mean, I just had to look at a wall and I could see Pujaswamiji and I could see Krishna and I could see Ganga. But nonetheless, there was something very, very deep and meaningful and beautiful about having these pictures taped into the inside of my assignment book. And every time the teacher would give us an assignment or I had to note down something, I'd open up the book and I'd have darshan, see the pictures, and I would just burst into tears. So there's something that a picture does, even though we know it's not really the flesh and bones of that being, that's deeper and more powerful than just conjuring them up in our minds. And that's why we hold pictures, that's why we hang on to them. In the same way, when we have images of the divine, it's not that anyone really believes that God only lives there in that statue. But that statue is God and God is nowhere else. It's that through that image, just like through a photograph, it's easier for us to connect. Just like looking at a picture of your loved one makes it much fresher and much closer than just closing your eyes and picturing them. But there's actually even another piece to it, which is that particularly in mandirs, in temples, there's actually a very, very sacred ceremony called the Pran Pratishtha ceremony, in which they take these idols that have been sculpted, a picture anybody can take. But when they do the sculpting of the deities, the murtis, the idols, it's actually done by very, very special artists who meditate and pray. They're much more like channelers than just sculptors before they sculpt the image. And then there's this very sacred ceremony that takes place in which for days the priests perform all of these rituals, the end of which is literally calling forth the prana, the divine life force of the divine into that statue. Now, this is interesting to think about, and I'm going to take you all a step deeper, because you are students, and so it's fun. Let's take it a step deeper and play both sides of it here. If God is everywhere, and if God is in everything, then why in the world would you need to call in the divine breath? I mean, the divine breath should be just as much in the lid of my water glass as in a statue into which, after days and rituals and whatnot, the breath has been called. And on one plane of existence, it is. On one plane of existence, absolutely, as we were speaking about last night, there is nothing but God. And this is just as divine as this, as this, as this, as the deity in the temple. But if we think about the different layers of reality, and we think about it like the old TVs where you literally had to turn a channel, and you think about turning a channel on a layer of reality, understanding that there's many different levels on which reality exists simultaneously. One being there's nothing but God. Another being that, yeah, here we are. Here we are in form. And here we are in form that feels, that loves, that has compassion, that bleeds if you cut it. And that's also a very, very real plane of existence. And on that plane of existence, through the use of very, very specific mantras. The Vedic mantras are actually seen as a science, the science of sound. It's not just a prayer, oh dear God, come into this statue. There's that devotion of the priests, but there's also literally an alchemical science of sound, through which these mantras, when chanted, literally have the alchemical ability to infuse that statue with divinity. And so what we end up with is these beautiful, beautiful deities that have been actually infused with divine energy. The point of the worship is for us. We must never get confused and think that it's actually for God. God doesn't have any attachment to our grains of rice or our ghee or our sesame seeds or our wood or our flowers. It's all God's anyway. I mean, God created the flowers. Like, why does he need us to pick them and then offer them back to him? I mean, if someone said, I'll pull out your fingernails and then give them back to you, would that be someone upon whom you bestowed great, great blessings? You'd say, just, you know, leave my fingernails where they are, please. They're mine anyway. The reason we do the rituals is for us. It reconnects us. If we are deeply spiritual and deeply disciplined enough, because you've got to be both, very, very spiritual and very, very disciplined, to have practices in our daily life in which we are constantly connecting ourselves to God, constantly staying connected, constantly remembering God, constantly surrendering to God, then no, you don't need to do idol worship. There's no need. You're living with God. But for most of us, we tend to let it lapse. We've got a lot of things on our plate. Our to-do lists are very long. Most of us don't make it through our to-do lists by the end of the day anyway. Forget taking out lots and lots of time for our spiritual practices. And so what the purpose of, whether it's idol worship, whether it's anything else is to reconnect us. It's not that God becomes happy when we offer him grains of rice or fruit. It's that God becomes happy because we've connected. Think about it for a moment. Someone brings you chocolates or flowers. Now, how does that make you feel? Good, right? But why does it make you feel good? Because you could certainly go to the store and buy yourself chocolate and flowers also. Why does it make you feel so good? It's the gesture. And what is it a gesture of? It's a symbol of what? Love. So that's what it's about. If someone wants something from you, you've got a test coming up, you're the smartest kid in the class, somebody else in the class who keeps trying to cheat over your shoulder and copy your things, or who wants you to give them all the answers, you don't want to do it. They show up with a box of chocolate for you. How does that feel? Does it feel just as good? No, because we know they're just trying to buy us. It's not a gesture of love, it's they're trying to bribe us. And if we are able, as just human beings, if we're able to understand the discrepancy between somebody doing something out of love and devotion, regardless of how expensive, it doesn't matter. When it's a gesture of love, it's not that you're happier with a huge 200-pound box of Godiva chocolates than you are with, you know, a homemade cookie, or with, you know, scribbles from a kindergartner who can't draw anything or do anything but loves you to bits and so has, you know, scribbled something for you. You're going to be just as happy because it's the love. Even more happy than someone who's trying to bribe you, who goes out and pays a lot of money for, you know, some very expensive Hallmark card or big box of chocolates. So if we're able to distinguish that, clearly God is as well. And this is why when we look at rituals, the ritual is not for God. It's not that God is happier with people who can flawlessly chant all these mantras or sit in puja for hours and hours and hours just doing it because they want, you know, to get a raise or get a promotion or to become prosperous, that they want something from God. What God wants is our connection, our love, our devotion. And whether that's expressed in a single flower, whether that's expressed in a prayer of love, that's what matters. I remember Puja Swamiji and I several years ago were in South Africa, and we had a program in Johannesburg, and he has some devotees who live a few hours from Johannesburg. And they had said, please, please, please come home for at least a night. So we'd gone to their house, and the next day we had to get back to the airport to catch our flight from Johannesburg. And they are very, very devoted people. Long worship ceremonies, lots of ritual, very, very elaborate, and they would spend hours and hours and hours every day in worship. And so it's morning and we're ready to go to the airport, and the man who's driving us and his wife are sitting in their worship. They're doing the worship and doing the worship, and it's time to leave, and I go in and I say, so sorry, but And he said, oh, yeah, we're just finishing. So another 20 minutes goes by, 25 minutes goes by, and I go back in and I say, you know, so sorry, but we're gonna miss the flight. And they said, no, don't worry, I promise you won't miss the flight. We're just finishing up. So by the time they finish their whole puja, we get in the car to leave, and it's a very good highway, and the man proceeds to drive at some, like, crazy speed. I forget what he was going, but it was literally like close to about 200 kilometers an hour in order to get us there. And he said, when we get in the car, I promise you won't miss the flight because, you know, the highway's so good. I've got this big Mercedes car. I can drive really fast. And, you know, the cops don't worry about it. So I'll get you there in time. So as we are speeding down the highway at, you know, crazy, crazy speeds, Swamiji finally turns to him and says, do you really think that God is going to bestow special blessings upon you for doing such a long worship ceremony that you have to kill your guru on the way to the airport? So I share that story because we do tend to sometimes get caught up in the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. And they're beautiful, beautiful, beautiful people, incredibly devoted people. But it happens to all of us. We get caught up in the ritual for ritual's sake, forgetting that ultimately the point is to connect us to God. And oh my God, I've got my guru in the house, who is the bridge between me and God, who for many of us is the embodiment of God, not even just the bridge, but the actual presence of God. But here I am in my letter of the law ritual that's now gonna, you know, make me barrel him down the highway at a very, very dangerous speed. So it's about the spirit, not the letter. It's about connecting to the divine. And that's the point. And if your religion, your culture, is not a culture of idol worship, is not a culture of ritual like that, don't worry. What matters is connect. You can create rituals. You can create rituals in any religion that you are. You don't need an idol to do a ritual. A ritual is just saying, here's a flower, I love you. A ritual is anything that you do for the one you love, for the one you're devoted to. And it's the same thing with God. And what rituals do, they're actually very, very powerful. There's all sorts of great new scientific research actually coming out about the power of ritual. Aside from the actual alchemical power of Sanskrit mantras, that even if you do ritual minus Sanskrit mantras, if you have the mantras, even better, because then you've got thousands of years worth of science of sound helping you along. But even without that, just the impact of ritual on our life, on making change in our life, whatever we want to embody, whatever we want to change, whatever we want to start. What's a New Year's resolution? It's a ritual. January 1st, at this time, I'm going to exercise every day. January 1st, I'm going to give up sugar. January 1st, I'm going to stop drinking. That's a ritual. It's a date, it's a time, it's a plan. These things are actually very, very, very helpful for us, which is why when most people start new things, they like to have some sort of ritual. It's why people get married. I mean, otherwise, why bother? You love each other, live together. I mean, why bother getting married? It's just a ritual. But it's a very, very powerful ritual. Ask any two people who have lived together before they get married, it matters. Something changes. You could have lived together for years before you get married. But there's something very powerful that changes in that marriage ritual. So rituals are powerful for us But we don't have to be Hindu to make use of them. We don't have to worship God in the form of an idol in order to make use of them. Whatever ritual is meaningful for us, we can create it. The last piece to mention on this, though, is that rituals with the actual natural elements, flowers, water, earth, they tend to be even more powerful. There's something about actually bringing in the natural elements. And this is why in India, the rituals bring in usually all five elements. The traditional pujas all have all five elements. But even if you don't have all five, if you've got water, if you've got flowers, if you're connected to the earth in some way, there's something that's just, because we're nature. We're made of the same stuff that nature is. And there's something that's just even more alchemically powerful about a ritual that calls forth that power in nature than just doing, you know, a ritual with the lid of my water glass.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. If God made us perfectly, which we always say he did, is it wrong to embrace the naked body if we are still able to accept that it's just a vessel or vehicle that we are in? There's nothing wrong at all with the naked body. Even from the deepest, highest spiritual level. Even from those who are on paths of very, very strict celibacy and renunciation. There's entire lineages, in fact, of Jain monks who are naked. Winter, spring, summer, or fall, in their own ashrams, on the streets, in functions, they are naked. So there is nothing at all that is wrong or not spiritual about the naked body. When we talk about embracing the naked body, then, we're talking, of course, about sensuality. Well, we spoke a little bit about this last night, or the night before, if you're in a relationship that is a married relationship, that's a monogamous relationship, that's a dharmic relationship, there's nothing wrong with the body. Yes, the body is a vehicle, it's a vessel. It's important that we don't identify as it, because otherwise then what happens is I become a slave to it. So whether I'm a slave to my physical hunger that wants me to eat 5 entire pizzas and 10 chocolate cakes, whether I'm a slave to my fatigue that wants me to sleep 12 hours a night, whether I'm a slave to my physical yearnings, in any case, the point is that we are not the slave to the physical body, to all of its calls, to its desires, to its yearnings. So in Indian spirituality, what you'll see is, for example, people will fast. Doesn't mean food is wrong. People will go without water. Doesn't mean water is wrong. People will stay awake all night doing japa, doing meditation. Doesn't mean sleep is wrong. Even married couples, dharmic, monogamous, married couples will come on yatra, come to the ashram, sleep in separate beds. They'll enter a phase of life after their childbearing years of living like brother and sister. Doesn't mean sex was wrong. All of these calls of the body are natural. They're biological. There's nothing inherently wrong about any of them. The wrongness comes when we become a slave to them. When it's the chocolate cakes in front of me, the pizzas in front of me, the hamburgers are in front of me, my mouth is salivating, I eat them. Doesn't matter what my mind says, doesn't matter what vows I've taken, doesn't matter what I know to be right or healthy, I eat. There's a six-pack of beer in front of me, there's a bottle of whiskey in front of me, it doesn't matter what vows I've taken, what I know to be wrong or right, I drink. I hit the snooze on my alarm every morning and never get up to meditate or do yoga because my body screams, I need more sleep, I need more sleep. So no matter how many times I vow I'm going to get up, every morning it's snooze, snooze, snooze. The body has sexual urges. We act on them. We suffer then when they're not in married, monogamous, dharmic situations. We suffer the repercussions of having acted out of impulse, instinct, desire, the same way that we suffer the repercussions the next morning of 5 pizzas or 20 chocolate cakes or a 6-pack of beer or whatever we've done due to the call of the flesh. We end up suffering not because God has punished us, not because it was wrong and we're bad, but because when we don't use the power of discrimination that we have, when we make the choice for pleasure over dharma, over our spiritual path, inevitably at the end of the day, we suffer. So when we talk about embracing the naked body, it's a vague question. If the naked body is that of your child and you're bathing, then by all means, embrace your child. If it's the naked body of your husband or wife in this dharmic relationship, by all means, embrace it. But if it's a path towards simply fulfilling calls of the flesh without an awareness that there's actually a being inside, the real being inside. Who's the one watching you experience hunger? The one watching you experience thirst? This is why we fast, why we stay up all night, even though we know we're going to eat again or sleep again, is to connect us in that moment with the one who's aware of me being hungry and not eating, the one who's being aware of me being tired but not sleeping, the one who's aware of the itch in my leg or burn in my hip when I'm meditating and not changing the cross of my legs because I've committed to just sit and not move. And when we embark on any of that, it connects us very, very deeply. That's why it's not about that these things are inherently wrong. Unless you're wearing orange and you've taken vows of renunciation, there's nothing inherently wrong with these. It's just that we need to remember, I'm not the slave to the desire. I'm not the slave to the flesh. I'm not the slave to the instinct. I'm the one watching it. And that connection and that awareness is really what our path of restraint is about. It's not that anything is inherently wrong. It's that the question is, on my spiritual path, in my life, with my goal, I don't want to be, as Pujaswamiji says, the light that people just switch on and off, on and off, on and off. So my stomach growls, I eat. I experience fatigue, I sleep. No, there's another being in me that says, not this to eat. Or no, it's my fasting day. And in that moment of fasting, in that lightness of fasting, not only does our sadhana come much more easily, but we actually access and connect with the one who's watching me get hungry, the one who's watching me be about to eat and reminding me, ah, no, it's our fast today. We're not eating. So that's what the point of all of the restraint is. Not that there's anything that's inherently wrong or bad. It's just a value judgment of, where do I want to go? At the end of this naked embrace, where will I be? And is that where I want to be? 10 minutes from now, an hour from now, day from now? Because it all has a ripple effect of repercussions. And what we also know is it's never enough. We always find ourselves saying things like, okay, this is the last time from Monday morning. Why is it that all diets start on Monday mornings? I mean, you'd think that somehow the stars aligned much more auspiciously, but it's not that. It's that we want to keep doing whatever we're doing, and we think, okay, what's the farthest next point? Monday morning. Because between now and Monday morning, I'm going to actually be satiated. Between now and January 1st, I'll be satiated. New Year's, I'm going to start. On my birthday, I'm going to start. That somehow between now and then, it's going to be enough. It's never enough. It's the nature of desires. Desires just breed more desires. And so the question comes for us of, when do we say, okay, wait, this train is not taking me where I want to go. I need to get off this train and on to the one that's taking me where I want to go, which is spiritual awakening, which is peace, which is real joy, real bliss. not that which just keeps coming from this pizza or this chocolate cake or this naked embrace, but the real lasting joy and peace. And it's not on that train. So eventually we get off and get on to the other one. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week. And I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.